And welcome back to Coast, filmmaker and now author Paul Kimball joining us in a moment as we talk about the other side of truth. And he looks at the paranormal, and he'll be giving us his thoughts on why he thinks it is. Fascinating story. So stick around on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest tonight, Paul Kimball, musician, songwriter, producer. That was all during the heyday times of the Halifax music scene. And then in 1997, he moved to the film and television industry, working as a program administrator at the Nova Scotia Film Development Corporation. He's been a consultant as well. The Other Side of Truth has been read by more than a million people since its creation in 2005. That was his paranormal-themed blog. And now he's an author, of course, The Other Side of Truth. Also did a movie about Stanton Friedman. And it was a documentary, Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings, and Stanton T. Friedman is Real. And I understand Stanton is your uncle, Paul. Is that correct?
Hi, George. Yeah, that's right. Stan's my uncle. He married into the family 35 years ago now, I guess.
So. Great guy.
So it always made for a fun family reunion when I was a young guy.
He was my very first radio interview back in 1971.
I think he was my very first UFO-related interview back in 1977 or whenever I was a young kid and he joined the family. So we have something in common there. Yeah, he's still going along, still trucking along, and which is amazing. He's in his late 70s.
Oh, it really is. His staying power is incredible. I mean, and he is, Paul, he's just as energetic today as when I knew him back in 71.
Yeah, he's just as energetic, just as controversial, just as opinionated, and just as fun to be around too. I mean, I think the thing that people maybe don't realize about him, because he comes across, you know, very serious, is he's actually a pretty fun-loving guy with a pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah, so. He sure is. How did you get involved in all this? And let's go back to your musician days.
My musician days. Well, I graduated from law school in 1992, and I articled, got called to the bar, which is, I can't remember what you folks in the United States call it, but up here it's basically you become a lawyer.
Yeah, same thing.
And then I said, well, I've had enough of that. So I was playing in a rock band at the time, and I decided I wanted to be the next Paul McCartney. And Halifax out here in the East Coast of Canada back then was known as the Seattle of the East. It was the early to mid 90s. There were a lot of bands coming out of Halifax. Sarah McLachlan had come out of Halifax just before that. So it was a good time to be a musician. So I spent 7 years doing that. Didn't become the next Paul McCartney, clearly. So,
well, you had the first name. You got close.
I did. Well, that was as close as I got. Although I did turn down a record, my old bandmates still chastise me for this. I did turn down a record contract with one of the major labels once, but that's a story. That's a story that's best left buried.
That was your nightmare, right?
Yeah, I always thought there'd be a better deal, and it turns out there wasn't a better deal, or another deal for that matter. Yeah. So there you go. But once the music career had run its course and I decided I'd had enough, I moved into the film and television industry, as a lot of musicians did back in the 90s. A lot of my old colleagues in the music industry are actually now filmmakers or work in the film industry up here in Halifax. So that's kind of how I got into it. By way of, you mentioned I was a program administrator at the Film Development Corporation. That's the government agency here in Nova Scotia that funds film and television. So I started out as a civil servant. And after a year of that, I decided that the private sector is where I would rather be. So
good,
I've been there ever since.
Good for you. Never looked back after that.
Oh, no. I look back every day and wonder, wow. Every time I see the bills, I go, maybe I should have stuck with that civil service job and that nice pension. But, you know, you have no risk, no reward.
And you're having more fun, I bet.
Yes, that's for sure.
Tell me about the switch to being an author. How'd that happen?
Well, the thing about, and I'm sure you know, I'm sure any media professional is aware, the thing about doing television, in particular television, which is what I've spent really the last 15 years doing, not all of it related to the paranormal, but a number of documentaries about the paranormal, is it's a very constraining medium. It's getting worse. The advent of reality television has made it much harder for a producer or a director to walk into a network's office and say, look, I'd like to do a serious film about this. I think it would be very hard for me now to sell a network up here in Canada on Stanton Friedman is Real, which was the first documentary I made.
Right.
They would look at it and they would go, well, a biography about a guy who studies UFOs, how is that sexy? You know, I like Stan, but I couldn't sell him as sexy. So, you know, around 2007, 2008, I noticed that that trend was happening, and the kind of programming that people are making now is not really the kind of programming that I wanted to do. So which is not to say, if anyone's listening, that I would never do television again. Don't take me the wrong way if you're out in Los Angeles.
For the right offer, you're there, right?
Exactly. For the right offer, I'm there. But I transitioned towards doing more feature films. I've got two under my belt now, with another one coming this year. But writing. So I had all this stuff that I'd written for my blog, paranormal theme, that I was doing these UFO and paranormal related documentaries. And I did a television show up here in Canada called Ghost Cases in 2009. So I'd been writing, I'd been doing television stuff, but a lot of it, you know, hadn't been able to get it. A blog is like a television show. It's very constraining. So a book was the natural kind of thing. I'd always sort of intended to do it, where I could really stretch out and really sort of think about things. And if it was a 200-page book or an 800-page book, I could do whatever I wanted. And I wasn't going to be constrained by a 48-minute running timeline or time constraint on a television network or something, or have a network executive tell me what I could or couldn't put in the book. So I founded my own publishing company as part of my overall film production company. And I said, yeah, I want to publish other people's books too. We have one coming up from Nick Redfern, for instance, later this year.
And he's a good guy, by the way.
He is a good guy and a very old friend.
That and you know a lot of people I know. Nick Pope, you know them all.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about working, you know, having done all these films, I got to meet an awful lot of interesting people, many of whom informed my own thinking. And in some ways, I suppose maybe my thinking informed theirs. And some of them became very good friends, like Nick Redfern, like Greg Bishop, like the late Mac Tonies.
That was a sad story. 34 years old, wasn't he, when he died?
Yes, yeah. Just after, not that long after his first appearance on Coast to Coast, actually. I remember listening to it he was on with you, and he said he had a great time. And then just a couple of weeks later, he passed away, unfortunately.
Heart attack.
Heart-related. Yeah, heart-related, yeah.
When you wrote this book, and it deals a lot with the paranormal, with an incredible theory, which we'll get into with you tonight, Paul, how did you get into that? How did you get into the paranormal?
Well, you know, it goes back to your first question. Stan Friedman is my uncle. So really, I was, you know, every family reunion I would go to every year, there were all my relatives are great people. So if they're listening, don't take this the wrong way. But when you're a young kid and you've got a guy there who's talking about UFOs and aliens, and it was around the time that Star Wars and the original Battlestar Galactica and all that stuff was coming out. And I was big into sci-fi, so I naturally gravitated towards, you know, hanging out with Stan as much as I could at reunions. So I got to know him pretty well. My dad, like many people in the 70s, read, and my dad was, you know, he was a lawyer and a judge, but he had on his bookshelf somewhere between the Criminal Code and Black's Law Dictionary, he had copies of Eric von Däniken's Chariots. Other books like it, which many people in the 70s picked up in these sort of old Fawcett or Dell, whatever they were, paperbacks. So I had access to that. So you've got Stan and I've got that. And it's just the kind of time that we all grew up in, the 70s and the 80s, where science fiction was big. The X-Files certainly coming out in the 80s, or rather the 90s when I was in college and in the music industry, all of that stuff. So yeah, it was just something I was interested in. I think it's something that I can't imagine how anybody wouldn't be interested in. Even, you know, arch disbelievers who go on to websites and forums and say, this is all crazy and everything. Well, they're clearly still interested in it because they're bothering to take the time to address it. So I think, you know, ultimately it's a mystery. It's probably it has to be the most mysterious thing that we can think of. Are we alone in the universe, or is there life after death? All that sort of stuff. And to me, that all falls under the rubric of paranormal. So, yeah, it was just kind of one of those things. Anybody with an imagination and a sense of wonder about our surroundings and willing to ask questions about whether there's something more than just the humdrum of day-to-day existence, I think naturally gravitates to at least an interest in the paranormal, whether that manifests simply by watching a show like X-Files or whether you go deeper into it like I did and like guys like Nick Redfern and Nick Pope do.
Well, it's amazing, Paul, how it affects you when you're such a young person. I was 14 years old when my mom brought home a book called We Are Not Alone. It was by the then science writer Walter Sullivan. of the New York Times, and he, you know, wrote this book about his theories that we were not alone in the universe. I was 14 years old, and I couldn't put it down, and I was obsessed with those kinds of books and those kinds of stories. I mean, I wanted more and more. My appetite for it kept growing. I bet yours was the same.
Yeah, I mean, my undergraduate degree is in history and political science, so I was more obsessed. This will not come out sounding good, but I mean it in a good way. I was more obsessed with studying Nazis when I was in college than I was the paranormal.
No, I understand.
I was writing my thesis on the origins of the Second World War. So.
Yeah.
But the paranormal was always there. You can't get away from it. My grandfather, on my dad's side, was a Reformed Baptist minister. I consider spirituality, religion, whether you want to call it faith, I consider that paranormal. The ultimate, as I make clear in the book, you know, the ultimate manifestation of the paranormal, if you really think about it, is the idea of God, of this sort of supernatural being that interacts with us. Well, that sounds pretty paranormal to me. So, I cheekily say in the book at one point, you know, I consider Barack Obama the paranormalist in chief. And it could have been George Bush or any president, because they all swear their oath of office on the Bible. They all profess to believe in God, mm-hmm. natural being. So we live in a culture and a society where the paranormal is rooted in our history and our very existence. Whether we really realize it or think about it or not, it's always there. It's part of who we are. So, yeah, you know, even if you weren't watching The X-Files or reading the book that you were reading or had Stan Friedman as your uncle, if you were going to church, you were interested in the paranormal. It's always there for all of us.
What do you think the paranormal is? So many people have so many different definitions, Paul.
Yeah, there's the good question that I'm probably going to have trouble answering, because I sort of make clear in the book that I have far more questions than I have answers.
Right, but you're not a skeptic.
No. Well,
I don't think so.
I think we're all skeptics in a sense, but I'm much less skeptical than I used to be. You're sort of investigating ghost cases. We'll do that to you.
Yeah.
And other things, and just getting to know people and sort of, I think, growing older, too, and getting more, you know, more aware of what's out there in the world and less sure of what your own personal opinions are. But the paranormal would be, I mean, anything that, you know, we have this world that we think exists, like, I can touch my desk, I can walk to work, and all that sort of stuff. And then there's everything else out there. To me, it's kind of a world of imagination where there are no certainties. So I make it clear in the book that, you know, I'm not preaching to the converted. If you firmly believe that aliens from Zeta Reticuli are coming to Earth, or if you believe that ghosts are your great-grandmother talking to you, or if you believe it's all, you know, bunk, on the other side of the coin, then my book's probably not for you. I'm somewhere in the middle where I say, well, all of those things are possible. But what we have here is a mystery. Ultimately, strange things, what seem to us strange things, happen to an awful lot of people. I'm one of them now. And once I started writing the book, I started thinking about things that happened to me when I was younger. And I realized, you know, I think strange things have been happening to me since I was a kid. So, you know, it's that to me is what the paranormal is. It's kind of hard to put a definition on. It's not just UFOs. It's not just ghosts. It's not just reincarnation or whatever. It's everything that isn't what we can see and touch and understand easily right in front of us.
And it's probably pretty normal when we really get down to it.
Sure. Because if you look at the universe, there's, you know, let's assume the universe is 100%. So if you understood everything about the universe, you would understand 100% of everything. Well, then I think our level of understanding, and that would be normal. So you would understand 100% of what was normal. Well, I think our level of understanding is 0.0, throw in about 900 zeros, and then hit a 1%. So all of the 100% would be normal. We just don't understand what that normal is yet, and we're a long way from understanding it. But that's what makes it fun, though. I mean, if we knew everything, what fun would it be? So that allows us to, you know, ask questions and get in conversations like the one you and I are having, or the one I have with my friends about the paranormal, and then just throw some ideas around. And that's really what makes it interesting to me.
When you started writing the book, did you uncover anything that you did not know about before?
I've sort of started, it became more personal, I guess, in a sense. So it's not like I had blocked incidents in my life out or anything like that. I just hadn't really thought about them, but they were always stuck in my memory somewhere. did I discover anything? So there was a the personal element. I started reliving some stories from my own past. In terms of did I discover anything about the paranormal new, there were subjects that I tackled that I hadn't really tackled before. Reincarnation was one of them. So I hadn't really, I was aware of reincarnation. I sort of had the Coles Notes version of reincarnation that I think we all have. But I was thinking about what seemed to me like some past life experiences, or at least potentially past life experiences when I was a kid, when I started thinking about it. And so I really wanted to delve into reincarnation as a subject. And some of the work of people like Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was looking at children and past life memories, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff, I had never really, I'd heard of, but I'd never really looked into before. And I found that fascinating and really interesting, too. Reincarnation would certainly be one of the subjects in the book that I write about that I hadn't really turned my attention to before. I mean, I was reasonably well-versed in ghosts and UFOs because I'd spent 10 or 12 years in various ways investigating or researching them or talking to people who had. But when I got into stuff, something like reincarnation and synchronicity, too, I have a chapter on synchronicities, which is a relatively recent thing for me to turn my attention to as well. And I only really did it when 2011, I was out in your neck of the woods, Los Angeles, for a 3-week visit, staying with my friend Greg Bishop. Mm-hmm. And just day after day, almost weird, I started noticing weird, strange synchronicity type things happening. And it culminated. Greg does a podcast called Radio Mysterioso. And so he and I and his friend, my friend Walter Bosley, another paranormal researcher, we were all in there one night talking about these synchronicities, and then they were happening as we were talking.
It's amazing how that happens.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun because Walter was, we were going back and forth on Facebook before I came on, and we were joking that we were both, he was in Los Angeles and I was in here in Halifax, but I was listening to your show, Rosemary, on 640 AM, which is out of Toronto. He was listening to it on a radio station out of Los Angeles that is also
640. That's right. Can't find.
And then I told him, well, that's not all. You were telling the story of Holly the cat, and which is a lovely story. And I said, I'll probably be on the air in half an hour or 40 minutes telling stories about my old Ghost Cases co-host and I, and her name is Holly Stevens. So I just thought of all the nights that George Norrie could tell the story of Holly the cat and have me on as a guest, maybe talking about Holly the ghost hunter. It's just little things like that. It's just kind of make you.
It is. And, of all the shows I've done, I've interviewed Holly Dale with her husband, Stan, about earth changes and events like that. But I've never had a story about a Holly, no matter who it is. And it's bizarre how the timing is for something like that.
Well, see, that just makes it even slightly weirder when you say you've never actually had a story.
Never, never.
Right? About a Holly in all the years that you've been doing this. So the one night that you do that, you have a guy on who used to, co-host a television series with a girl named Holly. And she's in the book there's an entire chapter where it's basically Holly and I nonstop.
And so there aren't a lot of Hollies.
No.
On this planet.
And that's probably a good thing. No, I'm sorry. She might be listening.
She's listening. That's why you said that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just kidding, Holly. No, it is. It's not a common name. So. It's little things like that that kind of, and then you think, well, okay, what do synchronicities mean? What does that mean? And as I started to think about it, and this is something that, I sort of address on and off in the book, the idea that, and I call it an advanced non-human intelligence. I don't say where it's from or what it is. That's open for debate, but we're interacting with something that is not human and more advanced than us. And through things like synchronicities and all of this other stuff, what I think it's doing is it's giving us a glimpse into something that's greater than ourselves. And the purpose behind that, at least as I see it, is to fire the imagination, to make us think, to make us wonder, to make us question, to make us dream. And when you see things like that, just the little Holly thing, it brings a smile to my face and it sort of makes me laugh. But then, it makes me think, okay, well, wait a second now. I'm sure that's a coincidence.
What if there is
a pattern here, and the pattern isn't trying to impart a particular message to me, like I should go buy a coffee or at this restaurant or whatever, but it's much more subtle and much more nuanced, I think. And that's sort of what the book's about, really.
Let's get into all of this, Paul, when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I have just returned from Denver, where we taped 4 television shows for the Gaiam TV network, and you can watch them for free. There's 10 days available to you. Simply go to this website, G-A-I-A-M-TV, GaiamTV.com/George, or to make it easier for you, Lex has a little link for you at coasttocoastam.com, and it's also under the host's name. The TV banner pops up there, too. Take a look at it. The program airs at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Fridays, but you'll also have free access to their unlimited library of incredible videos for 10 days. Take advantage of it. And welcome back with author and filmmaker, the author, of course, Paul Kimball, The Other Side of Truth. Paul, let's get into your thoughts in this theory that you believe that some kind of non-human intelligence is out there. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, I'd say it's not something that I would ever walk into a court of law and try and prove. So at the very beginning of the book, I just say I'm not interested in the sort of back and forth arguments that have been going on for 60 years about, is there something, isn't there something? I'm just going to assume that there is. And based on my own personal experiences, based on a lot of other people's experiences, I think it's a, without saying an absolute certainty, because as I said earlier, I only have questions, not answers. But at least for me, I'm pretty close to the answer on this particular question, which is to say, yeah, there's something out there. And I think that's probably, I came a lot closer to that answer given the 13 episodes of Ghost Cases I did where a bunch of weird things were happening to me and to the people around me as we were filming it, which I couldn't explain. So I think it all comes at some point, it sort of comes down to a very personal thing. Has it happened to you? Have you experienced something that seems to be outside the realm of what we consider to be normal? And we can see that throughout human history. I write in the book about a Canadian evangelist from the 18th century, which I can hear folks now, their eyes are glazing over and they're going, oh my God, he's talking about Canadian evangelists in the 18th century. But this guy, his name was Henry Allen, tremendous figure in Canadian history. And he had he left a diary, which is a primary historical document here in Canada. It's one of the great documents that we have to look at as historians. And in his diary, he described what he called his conversion experience, where he went from being, a casual semi-believer in God to, a diehard evangelist who went out and created an evangelical revival that swept throughout the maritime colonies. And he talks, the way he describes it, it's such a powerful thing. He talks about being wrapped up in God, being ravished by the Spirit. These are words that he used. He talks about time stopping, about how he literally felt as if time was stopping. When you read this, I know religious historians would look at it and they'd say, oh, well, this is just sort of what people would talk about in that particular time. I look at it and I say, well, yeah, I can go there, but I can also say, yeah, but that he's describing what we today would call a paranormal experience. He's filtering it through the sort of cultural norms of his time, which was to view everything as an interaction with a supernatural deity, God. In our times, it might appear to us in different ways. We might view it in different ways, but we see the same kinds of things happening. So there's not a whole lot of difference to me between Henry Allen in a field in rural Nova Scotia in 1775, getting wrapped up by the Spirit, ravished by God, and me sitting in a basement not too far away, actually, in rural Nova Scotia, investigating an allegedly haunted house and having something similar to that happening to me, where some weird paranormal stuff is happening. So both of us, even though we're 250 years roughly apart, you realize that this is nothing new, that people have been experiencing these kinds of things in different ways, all the way back to St. Paul on the road, well, as he was then, Saul on the road to Damascus, where he had the ultimate paranormal experience, and allegedly Jesus returned to him and converted him to Christianity, and he became, the founder of the Christian church, which is, not only the ultimate paranormal experience, but then the ultimate results-oriented paranormal experience, because it changed his life, and then he changed the world. So if you look throughout human history, you see all of these things, and then at some point you just stop saying, I'm just going to go with the flow on this, and I'm just going to assume that there is something to this. Because if there isn't, what harm? At the end of the day, what harm would there be? I'll die. I'll enter the void. I won't even know about it. But while I'm alive, I'm going to work on the assumption that there is something to this. And then it makes you think, and it makes you sort of wonder, the real question isn't who are they or where are they from? The real question is, what are they trying to say to us? What sort of message is being imparted?
And let's hope they're not trying to trick us.
Well, there's that possibility, too. I sort of view it, and you touched on this, I guess, in the first half hour. It's not a, I wouldn't call it a thesis, but it's sort of a theme that runs through the book, where I kind of look at it, and this has something to do with my own background, which we talked about as an artist of various sorts. I kind of view it as a form of artistic expression. And when I look at human history, when we're communicating, if you were an Albanian and I was in Peru and I was speaking Spanish, we wouldn't be able to communicate with each other in terms of our verbal language because we would speak different languages. So we're bound by the confines of our own language and our own cultures in terms of trying to really communicate. But the one thing that any artist will tell you is that you can transcend those boundaries of culture and language through art. So music communicates. I did two seasons of a classical music series here in Canada for Bravo called The Classical Now, where we every episode we'd bring in a young Canadian classical musician, tremendous musicians, and we'd interview them, and they'd play Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, whatever.
I bet they were great. Huh?
They were fantastic. I mean, it was probably the most fun I ever had doing television was actually just sitting there directing and listening to these people play and talk. But when you would ask them, well, what does this particular piece of music mean to you? And there's no words. They would talk in terms of colors and in terms of feelings and in terms of emotions that it would bring out. And it was music is communicating to you in a way that is not reliant on language and even on culture. I can listen to Tibet. I love listening to Tibetan throat music, weirdly enough, and Mongolian folk music. And even if they're even if they're singing, I don't have to understand what they're saying. The words don't matter. It's how it's the feelings and the emotions that are being conveyed through it. So when I look at the paranormal, I look at it as, and paintings are the same way. You and I could go to the Getty Gallery in Los Angeles, stand in front of a Jackson Pollock, and both look at the same painting, and then walk out and have a coffee and have a very long conversation about what we saw in that painting, and both of us could see entirely different things in it.
Right. And the other one would swear up and down that he saw something and the other person didn't.
Yeah, but both of us would be right, and both of us would be not wrong.
Right.
But you know,
yeah, there is no wrong.
But in doing that, we become co-creators. We become artists ourselves because Pollock's dead. He's been dead for many years, but his work lives on. He's communicating to us in a very real way from beyond the grave through his work. And we're still having a conversation. If you and I were in that art gallery, where we would be talking about what he had sort of communicated, if you will, decades ago. And what we get out of it might be different than what he intended to put into it. So what you've got is you would have this three-way between three people, two of us alive, one dead, and we're really co-creating the art all over again by putting our own interpretation on it. Now, if you take all of that, and this is sort of the weird way in which I think, and most artists think, but if you take all of that and you layer that onto the paranormal, to me it starts to make a lot more sense. Because the paranormal is as weird as a Jackson Pollock painting looks. It's as complex as a Bach toccata or a Paul McCartney song, for that matter. So there's all these things in the paranormal, and you say, well, okay, this to me seems like art, and literally sometimes seems like artistic expression. So you can take black light theater, lights, UFOs, lights in the sky. Well, what does that look like in terms of art? How would you describe that? Well, you can look at blacklight theater. You can look at extensive fireworks displays on 4th of July or at a minor league baseball game. You can look at some of the stuff that Cirque du Soleil does. I've seen a number of Cirque shows in Las Vegas. I love them all. But they're using lights. In fact, you can go see Mystere, which is the original Cirque du Soleil show, and there's almost no language in that show. You sit there for 2 hours, I think it is, and you're just transported to this other world where they're communicating all these things to you with lights and sounds and vision and no language. And it's a tremendous, you sit there with a 1,500 or 100 or 2,000 other people and you're sort of all together, but you're all having separate thoughts. And to me, that's what the paranormal does. So you could have people looking at UFOs and seeing them in different places in different times. They're like songs too. They're changing over time. So when I began my music career, we had a song called Mysterio. We started playing it as a straight-ahead pop song. We rearranged it over the years. We would play it as a country song. We would play it as a jazz. We'd play a jazz version. We'd play a hard rock version, a folk version, whatever, you know, felt right to us and whatever the particular place So if you're in a jazz club, you would play the jazz version. Well, the paranormal does the same thing too, I think. You can look throughout human history, what we call UFOs today, which we see as this sort of technological thing in the sky, we think of as spaceships. You look back and you say dragons. You can see all these things that we've seen in the sky over our history. But in each era when it's seen, it appears to people differently. That doesn't mean that they're to me, that doesn't mean that they're different things. It just means that who's ever sending the images out, and I think it is, I think they are images, are sending them out in a way that, that we'll appreciate as an audience.
And 50 years, it could change even even more.
It probably will. And they're reacting, again, it's the co-creation thing. They're reacting to what we're expecting and to what we are. And, you know, I think they're taking some of our own thoughts, some of our own consciousness, and saying, okay, well, there's an old Star Trek episode where they visit the planet, a planet with two warlocks, well, a warlock and a witch, and Kirk and McCoy, and they beam down. And they're in this medieval castle kind of thing with something out of Shakespeare with the three witches and everything. And Spock says, I think they're taking it from our minds. This is the most primal thing in your mind, Jim, that you can think of, this fear, these wizards and witches and black cats and everything. They're pulling something out of your mind. And I think that that's what the advanced non-human intelligence might be doing with us. It's pulling things out of our mind, and it's presenting it back to us in ways that we'll understand, all of which is designed to try and get us to think in a much broader sense about our lives and our place in the universe. At least that's what I think.
Why do they think they need to do that for us?
Well, that's a good question. I'd ask the same question. You could ask the same question of me when I was a musician, or Jackson Pollock, or anything else. Why does anybody have an artistic impulse? I think it would be, if you look at them and they're trying to do something like that, I don't think it would be something like, literally, we're going to come down and say, here's the message. I mean, there's good television and there's bad television. There's good films and there's bad films. The one note that you'll get on a feature film script above all others, if you come back, is they'll say it's too on the nose, meaning your dialogue is you know, it's too plain. You're telling people exactly what you want them to feel. There's no mystery. There's no intrigue here. You have to make it a little more nuanced, and your script will be rejected. Don't ask me how I know that. I can tell you from personal experience, your script will be rejected if your dialogue's too on the nose, if it's too simple. So I think, I think the same thing is true with the paranormal. They don't want to be too on the nose. It would be too easy. I mean, how would you learn? It would be like doing your math homework for your kid. If you have a 5 or 6 year old kid or whatever age there, and they come home and they say, look, I have my homework. Can you literally do my homework for me? You would be a bad parent, I would think, if you actually did your kid's homework, because your kid wouldn't be learning anything.
That's right.
It's not to say,
no, you want to help them, you know?
Right. You encourage them to do it themselves. You can even answer the odd question if the kid asks the right question. I remember a math teacher, he wouldn't answer, Mr. Morris, he wouldn't answer any of our questions. In fact, on the first day of class, he ripped the old math books used to come with the answers to the problems in the back of the book. He went around everybody's book in the class, got in a bit of trouble for this, and he ripped the answer pages out of the books. And he said, you're going to have to figure this out yourself. I'm here to kind of help you, but you're actually going to have to do the work yourself. But here's the problems, and here's the theory. I think the paranormal would work the same way. I view it as kind of a, you know, parents or an older brother, an older sister, or however you want to view it, and we're sort of children. And they're trying to encourage us to move up to the next level of development or to think about things in a broader way. But they can't force us to do it. And if they could, they probably could. But what would be the point? We wouldn't learn anything. We wouldn't actually become better people. So we have to do the heavy lifting on our own. But they can provide signs, they can provide clues, and most of all, I think they can do things that would stimulate our imagination, because I think it's in the imagination that true progress can be made.
If that's correct, Paul, then I think they're behind the crop formations.
Sure.
There's
absolutely
messages there.
You often hear people, I mean, I think there's no question that a lot of the crop circles are clearly hoaxed or faked or whatever.
Just takes one good one.
Exactly. But even if they are being made by humans, that's not to say that they're not the people who are actually making them aren't being inspired in some way, in the same way that Bach was being inspired to write a piece of music, or Pollock was being inspired to write to paint one of his paintings. So they're forms of art. Now, if humans are creating them, I think that's as valid and artistic, although if I was a farmer, I might think differently, but that's as valid an artistic expression as anything else. But I think there's, in some cases at least, there's something more to it than that. And whether it's the paranormal, the advanced non-human intelligence interacting with the people who are making, inspiring them to make these crop circles, or crop formations, they're not all circles,
right,
or whether they're actually making it themselves. I think, you know, you can work the muse, as a musician or any artist would say, can work in many different mysterious ways. That's the intriguing thing about the paranormal. It's all very mysterious. So, yeah, you're quite right. You've hit on it. Crop circles are a perfect example of how that might work in both ways, how they might be doing it themselves. You might wake up one morning and see this tremendous sort of pattern in a field or wherever. But even more interesting, I think, is the, and skeptics or debunkers, I'll say, just dismiss it when they hear that humans are making these crop circles. And I would say, well, wait a second now. That would be the same way thing as dismissing somebody who said, Mozart, for instance, who might have said, well, I felt inspired by the divine to write this particular amazing piece of music. And you'd say, well, okay, no, you weren't inspired by the divine. Well, maybe he wasn't, but who are we to say? So the crop circle makers could be inspired in the exact same way. And I've just compared crop circle makers to Mozart. So if there are any crop circle makers listening, they should be very, very pleased.
They love it. Let's get into some of the areas, too, before the top of the hour, Paul. We'll come back and talk more about it. You looked at ghosts, synchronicity, reincarnation. You looked at UFOs. You looked at just about everything. Did you find it to be all related, or was there an area that really stood out for you?
Yeah, that's another good question. And it might be very frustrating for some of your listeners. I don't know. I hope not. But I don't have a definitive answer for that. I do think they're all, personally, I think it's all related. I think it's all coming from the same place. So whether that place is aliens from Zeta Reticuli, and let's just talk about that for a second. So let's assume that the advanced non-human intelligence, as my Uncle Stan would say, are aliens.
I was going to say, you sound just like Stan when you say Zeta Reticuli.
Well, I do that. I've been tweaking him about that for years because that's the planet when he did the analysis of the Betty Hill star map.
That's right.
That he identified, or Marjorie Fish, I guess, did the analysis, but Stan's promoted it for years. It was identified as Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2. I still have some of his old pamphlets sitting in my office. So I could say any planet, but I say Zeta Reticuli as a nod, a tip of the cap to hat, Stan, as it were. So let's assume the aliens are from Zeta Reticuli. They don't even necessarily have to come here. If they're significantly more advanced than us, I think they might be able to actually reach us across time and space without actually having to fly here in nuts and bolts spaceships. But even if they did come here, even if they are here, I don't think that the sort of 1950s science fiction movie version of the spaceships that we sort of see and are reported are what they would be here in. Now, they might project those things because, again, that's what we... what they would have expected us to be looking for.
You mean like holograms?
Yeah, sure. Or perhaps something even more interesting. Holograms, that's sort of the way we would think of it in terms of Star Trek. But, you know, they could be projecting these images directly into our minds. They would, if you have the ability to travel from even the nearest star system to ours, which would be a quantum leap in technological development for us, hundreds if not thousands of years away from where we are, depending on who you talk to, then one would assume that you would have also advanced a lot more in all the other areas, including an understanding of how the brain works, of how the mind works, of how consciousness works, areas that we now ourselves are beginning to get a greater understanding, a greater grasp.
That could plant seeds in our brains from trillions of miles away.
Theoretically, I don't see any reason why they couldn't. In fact, it might be a lot more energy effective for them to do that.
Well, it sure would. Stay with us, Paul. We're going to come back with you in just a moment. Our special guest, Paul Kimball, his book, The Other Side of Truth, and we'll get into more of his ghost stories and theories like that when we come right back.